You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
My name is Ben Lucas, and I'm the Chair of Public Services at the RSA. Thank you all for coming. There are a number of people in the audience who've been also part of this project from a number of councils around the country, and I think they will probably make themselves known during the discussion. And I'm happy to involve them in this discussion. Grateful to everyone for coming. The purpose of today is to launch this report, Unlocking Our Wealth, which is the report of the Cooperative Councils Innovation Network Policy Commission on Community Resilience, Jobs and Growth. We are joined by a panel. First of all, Councillor Lib Peck, who's the leader of Lambeth Council and was the chair of the commission. And she's going to talk us through the main findings of the report. Then Stella Creasy, who's the Labour and Cooperative MP, I should say, for Walthamstow, who has had a long interest in cooperation and employee ownership and issues that are very central to the discussion today. Then Kim Hawthorne, who works as an apprentice at Sandwell Council. And finally, Simon Fowler, who's Partnership Registrar at John Lewis and is also the Chair of the Employee Ownership Association. I should say, for those of you who don't know, that the Cooperative Councils Innovation Network is a network that was formed, I think, 3 years ago, of councils that want to pursue cooperative values in the way that they do their business with their citizens and with local businesses and with their wider partners. And this is really quite a challenge, because if you think of a council, its formal name is a local authority. And authority, as a word, doesn't necessarily imply a great deal of partnership. So what these councils are doing collectively is to try and move into fairly new territory about what it would mean to create more of a social partnership with their citizens, businesses and other organisations in order to create and share wealth in their communities. This is really quite an important and new vision of what local government could be about, and it's by no means easy to make it happen. And one of the reasons that the network was created was to share practice, ideas, innovation, and simply what works in order to be able to develop a new way of operating. And it's an organisation which is a special interest group of the Local Government Association. It's open to councils of all political parties who share the values of the Cooperative Council Innovation Network. And the report today, I think, is a particularly important and timely report, because we're in an era in which there's now a lot of discussion of devolution to Scotland and to Wales, and also to cities like Manchester and Leeds, London and other places. But underlying that, from the Cooperative Council's point of view, is a more fundamental question, which is what happens to power? To what extent are citizens themselves going to be given power, as opposed to this being simply about transferring power from one level of the state to another? And what the Cooperative Councils are interested in looking at is how to unlock the wealth that resides in communities, which is really the centrepiece of the report that we're launching today, which looks at what kind of deals you could do with citizens, businesses, and government in order to unlock the latent wealth of local communities. So without further ado, can I introduce Lib Peck to outline some of the main themes of the report?
Okay, thank you very much, Ben, and good afternoon, everybody. I was delighted to be asked to chair this commission on community resilience, jobs and growth. It's an issue that's important to me personally and in my role as Lambeth leader. This is our first commission as a network, first policy commission. And we set out to review best practice, to develop a more creative policy approach. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel. We know there's plenty of compelling evidence from London councils, from the LGA, from Joseph Rowntree Foundation, to show that local initiatives are far more effective than the kind of one-size-fits-all national government approach. But what we did want to do was add to that evidence by injecting a cooperative approach, and to, I think, use this opportunity a few months before a general election to say that with this mounting evidence, it really is a subject that any new national government can no longer afford to ignore. And I use the word afford in both senses of the word, because when I move on to look at some of the finances, it really is an even more compelling case in a time of austerity. So the basic principle that we started off with is that local councils are uniquely placed to work with local people and in local employers. And we're able to respond to the geographic, to the social and the cultural challenges, and that we are able to help people into work or training in a way that the DWP simply cannot do. And so what I'm going to spend a few moments doing is, first of all, talk about the context and some of the challenges that we wanted to, or the context and the challenges that we think we're facing at the moment, draw out some of the good examples and some of the lessons that they give us, and then really just highlight the way we framed up the report in the end, which was a series of deals between us as local authorities and other key players. So we know really that for each local authority, and very, very different as they are, and we are an eclectic mix of local authorities on the cooperative network, I think it's fair to say, that there still remains a group of individuals who are missing out on the opportunities of employment. And that we also know that the currently nationally driven programmes do not recognise their needs and are completely ill-suited to coping with them. And we obviously got that substantiated by the Home Affairs Committee last year, when it found that almost 90% claimants of employment and support allowance paid to people who are ill or have disabilities on the work programme have not been found jobs. That's quite a stunning statistic. We've basically got a work programme that isn't working. We also know that there's a real skills mismatch between what young people are leaving formal education with and the demands of local businesses and the demands of the local market. And I can illustrate that in my own borough, where we have a huge regeneration programme going on in the north of the borough in Vauxhall, but where we actually know that the skill level, so i.e. the amount of skills training that's going on to make people or to enable people to become skilled enough to take advantage of those job opportunities, sits somewhere just less than 40%. I mean, that seems a real travesty to me. We've got the jobs, we just need to be getting the skills and the right people into those jobs. And of course, as of this month, young people are nearly three times more likely to be unemployed than the rest of the population, and that's the largest gap in 20 years. So something really profoundly needs addressing. Now, this report adds, I think, to that debate, as I've been saying, and it really did illustrate some of the evidence that local problems require local solutions and that we can be responsive to the needs of the community at hand. And we looked at some clear types of intervention, and I'm just going to illustrate a few of those by way of example. The first is a very fundamental one, really. We're often tempted, I think, particularly in big policy documents, to talk a lot about percentages and a lot about statistics. And I think the work programme is very much around form filling and ticking boxes. But what we're really talking about is people and treating each person as an individual. And that was one of the principles, it seemed, to actually drawing people who were furthest away from the market, furthest away from the employment place, into a job. I want to illustrate that with one example, which is a Lambeth example, but colleagues in the audience, this is my Lambeth example. I'm not about to just talk about Lambeth all the time, which is a fantastic little programme called the Tree Shepherd. Now, the Tree Shepherd are a social enterprise who, in their own words, work with the natural entrepreneurial skills of local people, support them to transform where they live from places of neglect to places of opportunity. And we have badged that in Lambeth Council as a social entrepreneur in residence. And I love that phrase, because what it is saying is that we have taken that approach to the heart of our council, and that we think it's a fundamental way to start treating people as individuals. And surprise, surprise, what you find from that is that only been up and running for a year, 147 Lambeth residents have joined their enterprise startup programme. More than half have now started training. And the estimated, independently estimated, social value of that project is now approaching £150,000. And that's in their first year. It's a very neat programme of attracting those furthest away from the job market into the job market. The second we found was that working with people to come up with solutions meant they were much more likely to succeed. And there's an example in the report in Edinburgh, where people with a disability, which if you remember I was just talking about in terms of the work programme were being most failed, have co-designed a new employment service, and it's already achieving 50% better outcomes. The third is from a different place. This is from Plymouth. And I want to touch on the third principle of intervention that we thought was important, which is around genuine social partnership. Now, in Plymouth, the challenge there is much more around creating the jobs rather than necessarily the challenge that I think we face in Lambeth, which is connecting the people up with the jobs. And so what Plymouth have done is very simply and incredibly effectively established a thousand club, which is led in partnership between the local authority and the Chamber of Commerce to create 1,000 new work opportunities for local people. And that, as a scheme, is now thriving. In fact, to such an extent that they're going to have to change the name. The fourth is to build on and share in assets. And we need to look no further than Sunderland for an excellent example there, where the Sunderland Software City, which is a partnership with the university to drive growth of software, digital, technology, enterprise, has provided support to 340 software businesses and 100 startups. Again, a really fundamental principle of some of the cooperative values that we are espousing as a network. And the final example, and we're going to hear more about this from the panel, is the role of the council as a leader and a broker. And I think Sandwell is a very good example of that. The Sandwell guarantee was only launched 4 months ago. And it's already engaged 103 companies, generating 193 job opportunities and placed 78 people into employment. It aims to support 4,000 young people, and I would suggest that it's well on its way to doing that. And I'm sure we'll hear very good examples about that in a minute. So the cases that we were showing was that local government was delivering, but critically, and this is very important as part of the devolution debate, local government delivering when it's working in partnership with local businesses, local community and local people. Now, it would be churlish to suggest, I think particularly in this week, that the government is completely not listening, or the national political parties are completely not listening to the devolution debate. We hear more exciting news yesterday from Manchester. You know, there is a growing awareness of the importance of local authorities. And on a much more minor scale, we see that in Lambeth, where we're in a pilot project, which is funded by the DWP, which is all around working with two other local boroughs, Lewisham and Southwark, on trying to make sure that we are really providing employment skills and welfare outcomes for residents with the most complex needs. So there are really good examples of, I think, government listening and of the political parties listening. And as Ben said in his introduction, you know, devolution is really the D word that is the word of the moment, probably, rather than the C, the cooperative word. But our challenge, I think, has to be that we really need to be making the case even more strongly, particularly at this moment. And so to get to the recommendations in the report, which are around three series of deals, a series of three deals, the first of which is advocating a new deal with government based on local freedom to innovate. We as local councils will provide and indeed are providing local leadership. We are capable and are indeed providing effective services. We are accountable to local people and we are able to win the trust of citizens in a way that I think sometimes eludes government. And in return, what we're asking for is the government to trust us, to share information, a lot more transparency around where some of those grants are going, so we can hold, in certain cases, businesses to account. But critically, to let us in to help design the systems that we know will work with for our local communities and to give us the resources to do the job. So there's a very simple call for a devolution of much more control around skills funding and for local authorities to have much more responsibility and funding to get on, particularly to provide for people with complex long-term needs and to help them get into work. And to be honest, if we can't make that case at the moment when politically the appetite is for more devolution, when local government is clearly the branch of government that is delivering, where we, I think, have established, and this report further enforces, the importance of the kind of values you need to make these things work, at a time of austerity where every pound needs to be spent wisely, we might as well all give up, and I'm not prepared to do that. So I do just want to make, well, I'm just on this point around the financial austerity, because I think there was one thing for me that really stuck out in the report. I've got several examples, but I'll try and wind up. But If every local authority played the coordination and brokerage role played by Southampton Council, we could see the value of developer contributions and commitments to employment and skills nationwide grow from 15 million to 225 million annually. There is a financial response that is really critically needed by this government to these kind of initiatives. Now, collaboration is wider than just between local communities, local government and national government. And so the second deal that we articulate in the report is a deal with business. We want that to be based on genuine partnership. As councils, we will take the lead in getting businesses involved in the leadership of the place. We will certainly develop local employment commitments to fair pay and training. And I know many of the councils here have got a commitment to a living wage to their employees. We certainly have. And we will try and do all that we can to broker that rather elusive relationship between schools and employees that is absolutely critical. And as part of that, we go through the importance of business taking part in local initiatives, sharing knowledge and other assets for community. Benefit. And the final deal that we articulate, which is a very personal one and gets us back to the first point, which is really around this is about people, this is about individuals, this is about individual opportunity, has to be around a new deal with citizens. And the report goes into a lot around the importance of what can sometimes sound like jargon, I think, pathways and information support, but essentially means sitting with somebody and working with them and understanding their needs and actually therefore empowering them and expecting in return individuals to feel empowered and responsible for the way they go and lead their lives. Now, we are a practical, active network. This is a policy document with plenty of good practice ideas in it. It has calls to government, to business, and to work with citizens. But critically, we don't want to kind of hang around, and we're not hanging around waiting for somebody to say, oh, that's a good report, we'll do something with it. So the report also has a commitment from, I think it is 13 of the councils involved, to sign up to a particular pledge in each of their areas to really improve employment prospects, employment opportunities from a very local base and by applying cooperative values. And I can later on talk about some of those, but to give you an example, Lambeth has pitched in with running a campaign to deliver 300 new high-quality apprenticeships in a range of sectors that will provide businesses with a highly motivated and well-prepared young person. There are other such commitments, all tailored to the local area from Oldham, Sunderland, Sandwell and Islington. But it's an important illustration for us at the end of a report that goes through some of the challenges, that goes through some of the ways we think we can tackle them and comes through with some demands on those key three sectors to also say that we really want to be getting up and moving and we want government to take account of what we're doing and to give us the power, the money and responsibility. But we're not hanging around to wait for that. We're getting on with the job at hand now. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lib. Stella, can we have a response from you?
Thanks, Ben. So I come at this debate perhaps what you might call poacher turned gamekeeper, possibly even pheasant. Now, having been both a local councillor, a community activist, a cooperator, and now a member of Parliament. And I'm extremely excited by what the co-op councils are doing every time I see the work they're doing, and it gives me great hope. And it gives me great hope not because of some of the mechanical arguments that people might make, and I think it's worth being very clear about that, because absolutely we see cooperative councils and things that are doing being much better at using scarce resources, and Lib admirably laid out a number of examples of that, whether it's the work that's going on in Stevenage around business startups, or the work in York around social care, or in Edinburgh and Oldham and involving people in budgeting. It's very, very clear that cooperatives are very, very good value for money. There's also some very interesting work being done by the Labour Finance Group and the Co-op Party itself about the purchasing power of government, about the fact that we're 3% of our GDP is public money, so clearly we can use that in much more creative ways. Again, if you apply a very cooperative principle to that, you see the case for it. But I want to talk today, in my kind of response to what Lib is saying, something more philosophical to it, which is the heart of the matter, is that why does any of this matter? Because my concern is to make sure that we understand why the purpose of cooperatism feeds the outcomes. And it's not simply about a process. And I think one of the things I've seen over the last 4 years in Parliament is a sense that somehow cooperative models are processes rather than at their heart a very values-driven approach. The ethos for me is best summed up by an American Methodist called William Arthur Ward, who said, "The more generous we are, the more joyous we become. The more cooperative we are, the more valuable we become. The more enthusiastic we are, the more productive we become. The more serving we are, the more prosperous we become." And for me, at the heart of cooperative politics and policymaking is a belief that, contrary, frankly, to both people in local and national government sometimes, people who want to participate is not a problem that you have to manage, but a resource that you can unlock. And so for me, when I look at what the work that cooperative councils are doing and cooperative movements around the world, in fact, are doing, is it's really to that spirit, that idea that it's not simply about being more efficient or even effective in office, but actually about how you can be more engaged. And when we talk about engagement, we don't just mean control, we mean creativity and unlocking the creativity that exists within every one of us for the benefit of all of us. And never more have I felt that's important, because the idea that 650 people in Westminster or even 60 people in a town hall can have all the answers in a world as complex and difficult as this doesn't make any sense to me. We know some of the great challenges that our world will face, whether it's around social mobility, enduring poverty, climate change, terrorism, the global economy. Our existing institutions and ways of working would struggle with just one of those challenges. But I passionately believe, and the reason why I got into politics, is that if we can unlock the potential of the public, we can deal with all of those issues and more, and we can deal with them in a way that actually means that everybody will benefit. And I think that isn't about everybody having all the answers, but a way of working together to get to the answers, to get to the point where you can make progress. The world of work and the things that you're talking about today is a great example of that. Because if we think about the changes that have just happened over the last couple of years alone, particularly the massive rise in people going into self-employment, the numbers of jobs that will be replaced by automation, the enduring challenges around productivity in the UK, the fact that, frankly, we are living through the beginnings of a Marxist revolution. The power to produce is increasingly in the hands of the workers. That offers up real opportunities, but also real challenges that we face within our society. And I believe that the best way that we address them is collaboratively. But that means that we need to have a way that unlocks the insight and the input of the people themselves in how we receive those problems. And one of the challenges has always been, particularly when it's come to perhaps addressing unemployment and long-term unemployment, is it's been very supply-led. So I thought what was very powerful about the report was the discussion about where you found actually young people being trained in skills that are irrelevant, frankly, for jobs that don't exist anymore, where you've got employers crying out for another type of set of jobs, another set of skills that aren't being addressed. It is good for employers to get involved directly in running this, and I'm pleased that Simon is here to talk about employee ownership, because I think in employee ownership models we see a lot of that, that forward thinking. But it's also very good for employees. Now, Lib talked about the example in Edinburgh. I'm a big fan of the Backer Project, which I think is another Lambeth example. I apologise. I promise you I'm not on a retainer to Lambeth. And that, for me, speaks to that idea about having a new operating system at its core of the way in which we work as a society. Because it's not just about employment. It's also, for me, across public services as well, about how do we create both the frameworks. So, for example, within the world of work, I think we need a new social charter to reflect the different relationships that people have. Increasingly, if you're not going to be employed by another organisation on a continual contract, you need a different type of employment right. How do we collect that collectively? It's within our public services. How do we give real power and creativity to people, not just to make choices about public services, but to have real voice in the services that they use, to be able to shape them, to be able to contribute to them themselves? And fundamentally, it's about creating that empowering culture. Now, at the heart of that is the elephant in the room that Ben alluded to earlier about power. And what does that mean for people like myself, the poachers, the gamekeepers, the pheasants in the picture? Because I think that means we have to change our understanding of what that role is. And I think that's what's so admirable about the Cooperative Council movement, is it's changing people's understanding of moving from simply being a decision maker or a manager even of a public service to actually being an advocate for change and an advocate for the experience and contribution that the people in the communities that you work with can make. And I think our job in the future is going to be helping people unlock their talent and helping people see all the opportunities in a very fast-moving world. If you take the world of business, it is now possible to set up a business very, very quickly. You talk to Jamal Edwards, who created SBTV, or if you talk to Julia Dean, who created the Cranebridge Satchel Company. That is hugely exciting to me, that people who previously would have been locked out of commerce and locked out of entrepreneurship now have those opportunities. That's why what's happening in Stevenage is so exciting, because it's helping people get access to that. But it's also about helping people understand the nature of change and risk. Because frankly, those taxi drivers who are complaining about Uber have a point. It's disrupting their lives. It's changing their lives. So what we need our politics to be, and why cooperativism is so important to me, is it's not about saying, stop the world, we want to get off, but it's about saying, well, how do we help you move forward? How do we help provoke change in a progressive way? Now, that's quite a scary prospect for many people, and I don't think we should underestimate how scary some of the changes are coming. And frankly, that's not just about cuts in public services. That is about the nature of the world that's coming towards us. But it's also about recognising that thinking that competition and creativity is a driver for growth isn't the same as thinking it's about the survival of the fittest. And that's why the cooperative ethos matters, because it's about that mindset, not just the method, that underpins the idea that we can get the best out of each other and that is of benefit. And that, for me, is really what Robert Owen meant. Now, my favourite quote about Robert Owen is actually that his father-in-law said to his wife, "Thou needs to be very right, Robert, for thou art very positive." And I think there's something very important about corporatism for me that I want to finish on, which is it requires us to have faith in each other. It requires us to have faith that no matter how complicated and difficult the problem is, we can find new ways of working, we can find new ways of collaborating. It's rooted in an idea that that is a job for all of us to do, not government alone, not citizen alone, but it's a collective endeavour. I'm very excited by what the cooperative movement is doing, both in local and in national government. I hope certainly to see co-op values being taken into the new government on May the 8th, and certainly it's something I hope to be part of as well, whether I be pheasant, gamekeeper or even poacher. Thank you.
So, Kim Hawthorne, I think you're going to talk to us a bit about your experience, the kind of bad experience of an employment system that wasn't delivering what you wanted from it, and a positive experience of what you've been through as an apprentice at Sandwell. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm Kim Hawthorne. I'm 19. I'm an apprentice at Sandwell Council. I'm currently doing my level 3, which finishes in September. I passed my level 2, which was quite good. I live in Smethwick, which is a borough in Sandwell. It can be known to not be very nice for many different reasons. Mostly, there's not really many jobs there. And if there are, they aren't very well advertised to maybe young people. I went to school. I did 4 rather than 5 years at school. I was a fast-track student, so I missed out year 9. And then I did 2 years of sixth form because of that. And that meant when leaving college or my sixth form, I was only 17 years old, so I wasn't able to get the funding for myself to go to university. If I did want to go, I'd have to pay the £8,500 for my first year out of my own back pocket, really. I spoke to colleges, universities, connections, and because we were the first year to have done this, they didn't know what to say, they didn't know what to do. So when leaving, but after doing my A-levels, when leaving, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't want to stay there because I'd already finished. I didn't want to go leave school because I wouldn't have been able to, again, to get job seekers, but I wouldn't have wanted to be on that anyway because from people's experience of, like, my family, they say it's not very good. So I found out about apprenticeships through my manager. I met her at a youth group that I used to volunteer at. She came to speak to us about what we wanted to do, and I told her my situation and she showed me what apprenticeships were. Before I got my apprenticeship, I volunteered at an event with them in the summer where they told me about the apprenticeship within the team, and I applied for it and luckily I got it. But being at the council has helped me a lot because really the different opportunities that I would have had when I was at college maybe wouldn't have got me to where I am now with the council. I wouldn't be speaking in front of all of you. I wouldn't have the confidence. I wouldn't have done speeches before. I wouldn't know about the world of work. Coming from school, I think that's one of the barriers, really. Coming from school, you don't know what an employer is looking for. They don't tell you that you need to be confident, that you need to... obviously, you know, you need to be punctual, but they don't tell you what a work environment's like. It's different to every place. You don't meet employers for them to tell you what they are looking for. All they tell you is you need this grade to get this job, and maybe that's not what you want to do, really. Being at the council has helped me because I've got involved with a project called Talent Match. This is the Talent Match in the Black Country. This is all about young people. So young people pick their own programme of how they want to get from what stage they're at now into employment. So firstly, when I got involved with this, I interviewed the project development manager and the young person's engagement advisor, which was new to me. I'd never been on that side of an interview before. So that was a good experience to know what to, from the other side, to look for in an interview rather than just being worried about it when you actually go. The project is basically the young person signs up and says, I need help, I can't get a job. It goes for the young people that are hidden, that are on job seekers, that maybe have barriers such as being homeless, having a young child, not being confident, different things like that. And it helps them get employment. So they meet with their mentor, so to say. They get to pick who it is, the person that best relates to them. They have mentors all from different backgrounds of life so that they can relate more to the young person. And the young person picks what programmes they feel that they would like to go on that would benefit them to gaining employment, whether that would be confidence building, learning how to work as a team, or just going to an employer and seeing what it is like in their business to see what it is like to actually work. That's also links in again with the Sandwell Guarantee, because from then young people can come to us and say, I am looking for work, can you help? And with them paying part of the wages for the young people to get into work, employers are more likely to come and say, I'd like to take one on for a year. And it might open the employer's eyes as well to what young people are actually like and what young people need, because some employers may not think, oh, they've got a young child, I can't have them because of the hours. But maybe they can, they just need to develop a bit more. It's like friends and family. Two of my friends went to university, they're still there, but they can't find a job while at uni. Whereas my other friend did an apprenticeship and she got a job out of it. Take one of my relatives, she did school, college, university, and left university with a teaching degree and couldn't get a job. But then other people went to college, tried to get a job in a school, and got it through that way, and they're employed. So it just shows that maybe university's not the way for everyone. But I just think that we need to start getting people to work together, like companies, councils, young people, to see what they all need to cater for everyone's needs, not just for one person's needs. And I think we're getting the young people to voice their opinions, to meet companies, to talk to people about what companies actually want is the way forward, rather than just saying, no, we can't employ you, and not getting any feedback from it. Thank you.
Thanks, Kim. Finally, Simon Fowler, I think you were going to talk a bit about both what John Lewis is doing in this area, but also your reaction to the report.
So thank you, Ben, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm the partnership registrar at John Lewis, which I'd forgive you for not understanding its sort of full responsibilities. But I sit on the John Lewis board. I try and bring humanity to commerce, and I try and uphold our constitution, which is the rule book that the founder left for us to abide by as we run our business. So I'm responsible for ensuring that the constitution is upheld and that leaders abide by it in the work that they do. It's a completely independent role. So I sit on the board with Andy Street on the John Lewis board, but I don't report to him. I report to the chairman. And that is absolutely critical, ensuring that the business, our business, is run in the interests of our employees that we call partners. So they're co-owners in the business, and that's really, really important as part of the ethos and the way in which we run our operation. I'm also pleased to be the chair of the Employee Ownership Association, as Ben has indicated. I've been involved with the Employee Ownership Association for the last 11 or 12 years now, have been chair for the last four, an organisation which is growing in scale, growing in size, and which is obviously putting forward the notion that employee ownership does generate more successful business and does generate greater productivity. So in today's report, I think one of the interesting areas that sort of comes out of it, and key, of course, for me, is the diagnosis that some people in our communities are missing out on the opportunities of employment. Looking at the national picture, it's particularly clear that whilst we're seeing strong employment growth, this isn't necessarily reflected in an even way across the country. And in some areas, there have even been some losses in private jobs. So building on this, one of the things that seems to be holding back growth in wages in our economy is a lack of productivity, worsened, I think, by both skills shortages and skills mismatches. So by that I mean that there are some employers who are struggling to find people with the right skills for the right job, whilst ironically there are some with highly skilled backgrounds who can't always find a job in the location that they want to find it in their local economy. And that challenge may, in my view, be holding back the growth opportunities of the economy on a national scale. So what does it mean for us? Well, both of those, as those who are engaged in issues in our communities and with a commitment to cooperative values and employee ownership, and also businesses like John Lewis and how they can do their bit and working with the cooperative councils to try and work out what might be the solution. I'd just like to give you maybe three thoughts. So the first is that thinking local can be really good for business. John Lewis has branches up and down the country, so from Aberdeen to Exeter, and we've even got branches now in Terminal 2, Heathrow Airport and St Pancras Station. And it's become clear as we've expanded that some of the things that we do much better are delivered much better locally rather than through any sort of centralised systems. So if I give you an example of this, in 2011, John Lewis opened a major new branch at Stratford City. It was 9 months ahead of the Olympic Games and was a real sense of excitement for us as a business and I know for the community. But it was clearly important that our new branch reflected the community in which we wished to trade. So we worked in partnership with Job Centre Plus to secure places at our assessment centres for people who were long-term unemployed. And I mean long-term. In some cases, some of those families had several generations who were unemployed. We recruited 150 partners from this group, and now 80% of that branch and partners that work in that branch come from the local postcode area. We're in the middle of a similar process now for our next newest branch, which is in Birmingham. So John Lewis Birmingham opens later this year, and we'll do exactly the same thing for all of our new shops. Clearly, this requires a really concerted and planned effort, but it's a different approach to simply listing jobs on a website, but we think it's worthwhile. My second point is that business can make a contribution to social fabric. One of the things that's perhaps a little unusual about John Lewis is that we have a written constitution. This document here that I've shown you, it's dated May 2014 because we update it from time to time. But it's written by the founder of the partnership and our elected body called the Partnership Council, which represents the whole of our partners, 90,000 in total across the country, are the only people who can vote to approve a change to that constitution. But it was drafted about 100 years ago and it's changed very little. But it gives the foundations of how we manage our business today. And one of the key principles in the Constitution is that the partnership will contribute to the well-being of communities where it operates, and we're still really committed to that today. But councils also have a role as key facilitators, linking businesses and parts of the community that need extra support to get people into employment, or with schools and further education colleges so that young people have really clear ideas of the jobs that are available in their local communities. And also the qualifications that they will need in order to compete effectively. So in doing this, I believe the cooperative councils really do have a very huge impact. My third and final point is about the economic contribution. So one of the main benefits of the John Lewis employee ownership model is our ability to take a long-term view. So we don't have any option to sell shares or to try and kowtow to any shareholders or the stock market. And so when you're going into owning a business for today, tomorrow and the long term, and you know that that ownership is secure in trust as the John Lewis Partnership is, you really can commit to supporting communities where you work, not only for today, but for tomorrow and for the next 10 years and the next however many years. We've been going 150 years so far. Clearly the world of work, though, is changing dramatically. Over the next 20 years or so, many of the businesses that councils are building links with will be seeing all sorts of changes, but some will still be trading. And there's much that can be done, I believe, to make sure that we're building the skills that we need for those future years going out. And critical, of course, for councils to be on the front foot and make sure that they're working with businesses really to identify where these shifts in the labour market might be so that we can build the right skills and those capabilities for the future. So I guess in summary, I've touched on quite a few areas here, but the thing that John Lewis does due to our ownership model is try to make sure that we keep a real sense of sort of ownership and localism in the way that we operate our businesses. There are more and more businesses with our structure being created as business owners see the benefit in giving employees a say in how the business is run and also a stake in their business as well. And we're doing lots of work to spread the word on employee ownership because, to give you just a few examples, around 80% of employee owners experience a sense of achievement, for example, from their job and are happy to recommend their organisation as a great place to work. The Employee Ownership Association publishes lots of information, but the latest is the Economic Case for Employee Ownership, which talks to the fact that number of employee-owned businesses is growing by about 10% at the moment. The gross profit in the last year of employee-owned businesses in the top 50 grew by over 25%. So there are lots of examples that recommend the way in which employee-owned businesses work, both to drive productivity but also to drive that sense of localism. Well-being, happiness and innovation are all really, really important in an employee-owned business, and we just look to trying to grow this model so that we can have a wider impact on the economy at large. But the good news is that there's a role for each of us in this room for flying the flag for employee ownership and cooperatives, and the Employee Ownership Association is a fantastic resource for any business that wants more information about how they might move to employee ownership. And in the 4 years I've been chairman, we've seen our membership numbers grow from 90 to over 250, and that's growing rapidly. So just a final thought to raise the profile of employee ownership more broadly. Last year, John Lewis partners received 15% of their pay in an annual bonus. That's their share dividend as a share owners, effectively owners of the business. And put simply, it means that we broadly take all of our profit at the end of the year, and about 50% of it is shared amongst everyone that works in the business. 20 to 25% of that bonus is spent at shops in the same local authority. And when we have a look at John Lewis shops and the level of contribution they make to the local community, about £9.1 million worth is shared in local economies through wages of the partners that work in John Lewis shops. So in short, I think there's much work that cooperative councils can do to shape the direction of local economies and the local labour markets. None of these solutions are straightforward, though, and it does require a really concerted effort. But I think businesses like us and like the cooperative councils can make a really big difference. Thank you.
Stella, I know that you need to be at a meeting with your council, and I don't want to detain you from that. But have you got time to answer any quick questions? Because what I suggest, if anyone's got questions, particularly for Stella, ask them now, and then we can carry on with the discussion subsequently.
Well, you're a prominent Labour MP, and on Monday, I think Blue Labour are launching their latest book. So I wanted to ask how you think this kind of cooperative worldview relates to that communitarian worldview that's got some impetus on the left as well.
Sure. Thanks, and if you want me to be even more philosophical, I'm a big fan of what you're doing in Islington, by the way, and the reason I'm a big fan of it is because I think the left has to be rooted in the future if it's to really progress social justice. So we might look at different models and different methods of engaging people, but fundamentally we had to ask ourselves, what are the concerns of the world to come? Because that's where most of the inequalities that we see come. So in that sense, when I look at some of the Blue Labour stuff, I have to say I wrote an entire PhD about why Robert Putnam was wrong, which was great fun to do, especially when I told him that. But it worries me if we get so caught up in the idea there's a particular way of organising people, when actually, why does that mindset matter? Why does that creativity matter? Because you're all finding different ways to respond to the challenges that are coming down the line. So the work that you guys are doing in Islington, for example, on debt, for me is amazing, but it's reflecting serving a community in London that is facing a lot of debt coming into it, a lot of different predatory organisations, a lot of challenges around unemployment and long-term lack of skills. That's very different, say, to some of the challenges that might be facing some of our rural communities. We forget at our peril the world we're trying to create if we get hung up on that process. That's why, for me, it's a red herring to think about local or national government. You've got to think about people. And the biggest response to me for tackling the idea that all of this comes if you just marketise, if you just bring in the notion of competition, somehow we'll make all this work, is people themselves and how you actually get their contribution into it. But that's about change, and change is very difficult to do. So some of the Blue Labour stuff for me sometimes feels a little bit like it's saying we don't have to change. I want to create more change, I want it to happen more quickly, and I want it to be more egalitarian. And that's where I think the co-op movement has some really distinctive and creative ways to think. And that's why, for me, Robert Owen wonderfully on his deathbed also said, well, I was ahead of my time. If people disagreed with me, I was right, I was just ahead of my time. We shouldn't lose that passion and that energy, that there is a solution to be found that fits for the 21st century, which is that energy that Robert Owen also brought to cooperative values in the 19th century.
One more question for that. We've got time for...
Yeah, go on.
Two quick questions, okay. Greg at the back.
Hi, Greg Parson from Imperial College.
You're not from round here, are you? I can tell.
No, I'm from Fulham. and I have been since 1983. It's just that the accent helps when I get stopped by the police. There's a lot of talk about cooperatives, and that's great, but I'm much more interested in cooperation and collaboration. Labour seems to be behind the ball right now in its response to what's happening in Manchester. And I wonder whether you could tell us, not what the official line is, but what your views are on that. If the Manchesters of the world go ahead, and I think it's a phenomenal achievement, attributable probably to Simon Stevens more than Jeremy Hunt, it's going to mean that the way services are delivered there and maybe even outcomes are going to be different for the elderly, for children, for everybody else. That's going to really challenge Labour's stands around postcode lottery and all that stuff. How are you going to let all this local collaboration and cooperation take place if things are going to be different in different parts of the country?
Greg, you raise a really interesting question, but it's a question that the left, frankly, has been challenged by for generations. I mean, Tony Crosland had the same arguments about whether it was equality of outcome, equality of access. I think there's a red herring in this issue, which I genuinely believe, which is about whether it's local or national. Because the test for me, for the Manchester model, and we'll see what the model that comes out tomorrow is how are people being involved in it? Actually, how are we giving people real power? Power isn't two bad choices, but you get to choose between them. And let's be frank, some of the problems with previous generations has been that we've talked about choice, and it's really no choice at all. And I see it, for example, in housing, my local area, where we say to people, well, it's a choice-based letting system, but the choices are terrible. It's got to be about voice, and it's got to be about the connection between voice and choice, because real power is actually about being able not simply to say, I want this individually, but to collectively work to change that terms of reference. And I don't take your term of reference that the left is behind on this, because I come from that cooperative element within the Labour movement, which has always been trying to put the two together. And that's why I think what the co-op councils are doing is really, really interesting, because it is absolutely about marrying voice and choice together, about saying to people, this is not just about us doing things better for you, but how we work with you. So, for example, on some of those business programs in Stevenage, you know, most businesses, something like 96% of startup businesses go to the wall. And so half of startup businesses go to the wall. 96% of the businesses in the Stevenage project have retained for a year. That isn't just about the council propping up those businesses. It's actually about the collaboration between them and the benefit for the local community. It's the same around social care. So we have to see what the Manchester model is and whether it does offer genuine empowerment for people. And I think that should be the test for us, not whether it's being done at a local or a national level. Because if I'm frank, having been a local council, a councillor, local councils can be as controlling and as disengaging as national government can be. It's not about the location, it is about the ethos. That is why the mindset matters. That kind of fits onto your point, sorry you didn't say your name, sir, about private sector models. The thing I'm really passionate about are consumer clubs, which is something they've done in Australia, where because they have worked together as consumers to purchase goods, they've actually been able to set the terms of trade, not just in terms of energy prices and energy contracts, but also health and social care. How have they done that? Because it's about accessing information. And one of the challenges we've got right here in this country right now is it's really hard to get information. And Lib is absolutely right when she talks about it. I am the shadow consumer minister, and I have singly failed to switch my energy bill. Because when you look at the data, you can't actually find out how much you need to pay for what you're trying to use. There's a project called My Data, which has been a failure, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, over the last 4 years, because it's been about trying to get companies in the private sector in the UK to share data in a portable and accessible format with consumers. Well, oddly enough, it's not really in their commercial interest to do that, because then you might be able to switch. I want to see the My Data project being enacted, but I also want to see it being applied to the public sector, because I would like to see local people being able to say, not just to Lib, well, hang on a minute, we see you're spending this on social care, can we do it in this way? But we've had an idea, and here's how we think we can contribute to it, and we're basing it on the evidence that we've got. If I could make just one plea to every local council, it would be please publish your school catchment areas in London, because the numbers of people who come to me having not got into the school they want to get to because they didn't have the information about what the catchment area is, so what's the right way for them to bid, is immense. Basic information makes a massive difference to empowering people. And alongside the advocacy structure, which is what co-op councils are so good at doing, so I say, we see it in Stevenage, we see it in York, we're seeing it in Lambeth and in Islington, you can help people make better choices for themselves, and that is the most empowering process to be. We should never lose sight of the public in all of these conversations. We should always think that the politicians come afterwards. You know, if we get all of these structures right, the question, well, you should go and see your MP about that, will just stop being asked, and I will have a much better life as a result.
Talking of having a better life as a result, Stella, you presumably need to go to your meeting with
your council,
otherwise you won't have a cooperative relationship.
Yeah, I know.
So, but thank you very much for coming and for your contribution. Now, we've had some really interesting contributions about the main recommendations of the report, about the value of businesses approaching this in a different way, And some very interesting points from Kim about the kind of rigidity of the system, basically, that the lack of ability to make any kind of tailored decision or judgment, which led you to be in a situation where, because you finished at 17, there was no way of dealing with that. And which I think is a lot of people's experience of the kind of square pegs into round holes of the way in which the employment system works. And it'd be interesting to sort of, I think, pick up on some of those points in the discussion and along with the other points that people have made about what do people feel is the current scope to be able to do things. One of the things that Lib said is that there's a determination on the part of the cooperative councils, not just, as it were, to wait to be given the authority to do this, but to try and get on and do this. And we've already heard from places that this is happening, and we've heard from Simon about what John Lewis is doing. So it'd just be interesting to get your reflections on where you think things are at, what some of the practical barriers are, what you see as being good ideas that we maybe didn't have in the report that we could take up. So, the floor's yours.
My name's Miriam Aquilina. I want to talk about a project I was involved with. I lived in Malta about 15 years ago, and it was called Scoops. It was schools co-ops. And I worked for a co-op, and we set up co-ops in schools where the young people paid to become members of the co-op. They ran their own meetings. They decided whether they were going to provide a service or create products which they would then sell. And at the end of the year, then they had some, when they distributed the profits amongst themselves. And it gave the kind of confidence that Kim's talking about to these young people, because once a year we had a fair where they could actually show what they had done, and they could also speak about the work that they'd done in a public speaking kind of way too. And I just thought schools at the moment are not really working collaboratively. Everything is competitive. So we need to think about how in schools we can get back to more collaborative styles of doing things. And this was like a lunchtime club, that the young people ran this in their own time. Some even came in on Saturdays to do things. I just wanted to say, you know, it can start earlier.
Sorry, I'm Derek Watt. I'm a fellow here and former Labour MP. Simon, I just wonder if I could ask you whether you've considered at John Lewis creating the equivalent of a public equity fund for startups.
Just back on the point of schools, actually the commissioning of schools, I think the whole free school movement really has to have a really big rethink. There have been a few co-op schools set up, but they're quite few and far between. And it's an area that has been incredibly divisive in the communities, and it oughtn't have been. And I think this is something that really needs to be looked at so that we actually get the right type of schools in the right locations, and so the children are actually educated and then can progress to employment.
Okay, I'll take those three to start with and we can come back for more. Lib, do you want to... If it's okay, I'll ask every one of you to come in on... You don't have to answer every one of the questions, but whatever feels appropriate to you.
Sure, okay, thanks. I'll go to the first point, actually, which was around sort of more empowerment, in a sense, wasn't it? And more collaboration of young people. And draw on an example that we... a project that we're engaged in Lambeth, which is that we decided, not through the schools network, but that a few years ago, that we knew that we had youth services which weren't really responding to what our young people wanted. And so that we thought a better idea would basically be to set up something called the Young Lambeth Co-op, which was an open membership to both young people and adults to engage in, and from that to develop a board and to empower that board to basically commission the youth services that they felt were appropriate for the borough. So they've just gone through, it takes a long time, these things, actually. I think that is one thing to highlight. It's taken a long time to develop the kind of capacity and the skills and the know-how to commission services. But what we were actually sure of and remain true to is the fact that young people are probably in a better place to determine what kind of services they want rather than, you know, older people sitting in a council and deciding it for them. And so it'd be very interesting to see, given this is its first year of empowering these people, to see what they come up with. But it came on the back of a scheme, I think, that we've been very proud of in Lambeth for a long time, which is developing a young mayor, a youth mayor, and that extending into having a youth cabinet, and us as a cabinet trying to work very closely with young people. So I'm all for that. And I'd also like to challenge a little bit the idea that all schools are in competition. I mean, you're right, the kind of relentlessness of statistics and league tables does sort of engender that kind of attitude. But certainly in Lambeth, and I'm sure in many other local authorities, we've looked to try and set up what we call federations, which are essentially quite supportive networks of local schools so they can learn best practice from one another and use one another's facilities and, give each other support. And that actually has worked. So all for collaboration and all for empowerment, I suppose, is what I'm saying in response to your question. Free schools movement, well, absolutely. I'm not a fan. I think it's completely ridiculous that, for example, at the moment we have a free school in Brixton Hill where we have no shortage of secondary school places. And indeed, this morning I was looking at the figures and I think there's 25 people enrolled as their first choice. You know, that was just planted in our local area, wasn't really wanted by most of the local people, isn't serving a local need, and yet it's costing money. So, you know, I think ridiculous waste. I think those were the two questions for me, wasn't it? You got the very specific one.
Kim, there were some particular questions as well about schools and about the importance of being given a voice and the way in which schools operate to prepare people. Just wonder what your thoughts are about that.
In schools, they're more worried about you being academically capable of going into a job. So they want you to get your maths, English, ICT grades. That's what they think you need. Whereas me, for example, at my GCSEs, I took childcare, sport, IT, and I can't remember the last one, but none of them are important in my job that I'm doing at the minute. And then for A-levels, I took psychology, IT and sport, and again, none of them are important. They are all worried about, oh, you need to pass, you need to get A's, B's, C's for these grades. But realistically, thinking about it now, I'm never hardly going to use those subjects again. The one I might use is IT, because things are mainly on computers, but the rest of it I'm hardly ever going to use in my life again. They don't seem to understand that you need to know, not just getting your grades, but you need to know what work is like. You need to actually see it, because they think that, oh, if you get your grades, you'll get anywhere, but not necessarily, because there's some people that do go straight into work, and there's some people that do sit at home on job seekers because they haven't got experience, but they can't get experience because a company won't give them the opportunity to gain that little bit of experience. So I think this is what schools need to understand. If they work together with companies, doing more enterprise challenges or something like that where companies come in and talk to them or they create their own ideas, then I think that would be better. It's like I'd come to Tottenham the once with a project that we was running. We came up with an idea, marketed it, come up with all the background, all the funding, everything that we'd need for this project, and we had to present it in front of an audience to see who would win this so-called challenge. But that shows you, from a higher perspective, what it is like in a company, whereas my grades didn't really matter. Every young person is different. One thing's not something that would work for me, so to say, wouldn't work for a child that's less fortunate, that does have parents that are sitting at home on the backside watching telly all day, because that's their role model. You need people that are positive role models in your life for you to get the experience. If you see sick people in your day-to-day life that aren't doing anything and they're getting money for doing nothing, then you're going to think, oh, let me do that. Whereas it's better to be working, and young people probably won't see that.
Thanks.
Good. Simon. Derek's question, I think. Thank you for it. John Lewis is already doing a lot of work at the moment to try and help both start-up companies and organisations that want to become employee-owned. So next week there's going to be an announcement where we're going to be trying to select a company that we're going to support financially to try and help them get themselves started up as an employee-owned business for the future. We work through the Employee Ownership Association with the Baxendale Partnership that actively go out to try and seek capital for those that require it to enable their businesses to grow and to flourish with solid business plans. But we also give a lot of time as well, so it's not just always about sort of equity funds and money. It's sometimes about knowledge and sharing experience and giving confidence to people that they actually do know what they need to do. They just need a few pointers. And I suspect that we probably spend an awful lot of time with people helping them with their ideas and their thoughts and just crystallising their thoughts towards, you know, either becoming an employee-owned business or growing the stakeholder population within their businesses. Not everyone is 100% owned, but certainly moving towards that magical 50-51% mark is quite momentous. So we do quite a lot of that, but watch next week because there is an announcement being led by the Employee Ownership Association where we're looking to support a start-up business.
Any more questions? Yeah, I'll take Councillor Penberthy.
Just a thought on schools. In Plymouth, our schools have been working cooperatively together for many years. And, in fact, every supply teacher in a primary school in Plymouth will come from a co-op owned by primary schools. And those primary schools are now providing school meals, or as of 1st of April, to 67 schools in the city, meaning that the school meal service, which the council can no longer sell to schools under government legislation, has been saved for schools. And that's paying the living wage, local purchasing and everything else. So by working cooperatively, our schools are already doing it. But what I was really interested, I visited Lipsham College, one of our cooperative schools recently, and talked to a load of the pupils. I talked to some boys who had designed one of these battery-type cars that go into the competitions for who can go the furthest. They had beaten the teams backed by Jaguar and Land Rover and won the national championships. They go to the school, one of the schools in Plymouth that picks up kids from the most deprived communities. It's a school that provided meals for probably half of the Fairness Commission meetings in Plymouth, not from the school canteen, but from the co-op run by pupils at the school, who provide, as well, entertainment to most of the big events in Plymouth where a big band is wanted, because they've got the best big band in the city. Now, those aren't run in spare time. The school teaches cooperative principles as a way of living your life and gives time every single day, and the pupils opt into the themes and the clubs and the activities they want to do. And it's really interesting watching the way that when you begin to put the principles into practice in a school, children and young people working with teachers can raise money, build businesses and employ people that actually mean that they're teaching music and buying new instruments at a point where government stopped funding it. And I just think that the cooperative principles, when you begin to put them into practice in public service, can be massively different. And one of the things we've discovered as a network is about how you share that across, because there's all this stuff happening at a very local level. And I think what we're doing is working out ways to share and not replicate, but learn and introduce that to other people. And I think that's one of the keys to the network, and actually one of the keys to the report. Don't just pick up an idea and redo it. Pick up an idea and talk to your local people about what it can mean,
yeah,
and how it will work in your local community.
Okay, I'm going to take it.
Ben, if I could, can I just jump in? I've got a question on free schools over, yep, there, and I know it sort of maybe didn't have as warm a response from Lib maybe as it might have been because of the locality, but I'm a non-executive director on the board of LIPA, the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts, which is based in Liverpool. It's like the Liverpool Fame School, I guess, founded by Paul McCartney, and they're opening a free school, and I think one of the things that really motivates me about that being a good idea in that location is that because it's going to promulgate performing arts, it's going to help young students to learn the basic curriculum but not be deprived of the creativity and innovation that the performing arts brings to young people at that very early forming stage, where it's very important to their education. And unfortunately, in much of mainstream education, that seems to be being removed as a loss, I think, to the student populations as a whole.
Okay, thanks.
Hello, Charlotte Aldrich, Director of Public Services and Communities. On the one hand, we've heard a lot about the left this afternoon, and then I've also heard a lot about ideas and policy that I think would be applicable across the political spectrum, the role of information or employee ownership or how we may address skills and welfare. So I just wonder, to what extent could we make cooperative principles a really cross-party issue?
I was very struck by what Simon said about having social value built into the constitution of John Lewis. Unfortunately, most employers don't have an owner who left behind a constitution, and I wonder what is the role of, talked about local government as an enabler, how do we start opening up those conversations with businesses? Is it through some of the more formal mechanisms of the Section 106 or collective buying power that's been mentioned, or is it through more informal influencing?
Janet Sutherland, the Academy of Urbanism. Question to Lib. Given our broken housing system, the very really innovative example that you're doing in Lambeth with your using your own land with cooperative principles to provide affordable housing, why aren't we doing more things like this?
Just a quick one for Lib, really. It's nice to be soft and cuddly with people like John Lewis around, but there are Circos in the world and there are other companies. What do we do? And you talk about all the nice things that companies can commit themselves to and what you expect from businesses, but what do we do with the businesses like Circle that pulls out of Hitching Brooks, or like the academies that start to put soft drink machines and candy back in their lunch pails?
And then question here.
Hi, I'm Jo Monroe. I undertake research on accelerating innovation in local government. A lot of the councils I've been talking to don't seem to be undertaking the sort of in-depth community consultation that I think is an important building base for really successful innovations. I mean, some are doing, obviously, like Lambeth and York and Surrey and a number of others, but I've been very surprised at how superficial or almost minimal some of the consultation has been. And I think it's partly that public meetings and even focus groups have got a bad reputation for, you know, the usual suspects come along and complain. So I wonder if you've found innovative methods of actually really understanding in much more deep depth what citizens want.
We've talked about the structures. I was just wondering, buying outcomes in a way that supports innovation and can be kind of bought at social outcomes, whether it's employment or health and social care. At Big Society Capital, we're trying to build a social investment market where I come from, and I was wondering, it can be commissioned at a cooperative, local, or national level. How does that inspire innovation, and did you look at that for the report?
And one final, there was a question there, and then that really will be it. So,
thanks very much, Ben. Nick Matthews, I'm the chair of Cooperatives UK, and absolutely delighted to be here to hear about this work. I think one of the things I would emphasise is that cooperatives, they are private sector businesses. So there's no doubt in my mind where they live. But also, I think the example of John Lewis is very interesting, because Speed and Lewis didn't throw the workers out of the business and say start your own supermarket or your own department store. He actually gave them the buildings and the assets. So I think the important thing, one of the things we need to think about with local government, if we're really serious about creating a genuinely cooperative or mutually owned social care system, for example, we're going to have to transfer public assets to the private sector in a different way than we have been doing it hitherto, which is, I think, quite a challenge. My final other point is there are 700-odd cooperative schools around the country, so I think there are some very good educative role models out there. And lastly, within your geographical territories, it's very important that you gain the skill set to help people to form cooperatives. Because as much as I would, and by the way, I love to hear Kim's accent. It's nice to hear somebody with a proper accent for a change. Whilst it'd be great to get as many young people or any young people into employment, the simple fact of the matter is in the next 10 or 15 years, there are not going to be employers taking on the million or so young people that are out there already. And what we're going to have to do is they're going to have to create their own employment. They're going to have to create new businesses and create their own opportunities. So we have to create the framework that helps them to create the cooperative enterprises that can do that. And I think within your own territories, having the facility and understanding and competence amongst officers of the local authority who can help to advise people how to do things for themselves is a crucial part of this equation.
Thanks, Nick. Right, a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. Come back on what you want. You don't have to respond to all of them, but just come back on the ones that you can most usefully say something on.
Okay, I mean, I think there were some questions around business and social value that I think were interesting. Local procurement, much underrated, but an incredibly powerful tool at a local level that we need to exploit and make sure that we are looking at in a very holistic way so that we are seeing it to enhance the local economy, I think is important. Absolutely, you know, we need to be sweating our Section 106s because that's an important way when you convince people of the input they can have to a local area. And I think we need to be making connections with local businesses and couple of the ways in which we're doing that, and then coming on to the final point around startups, we have 6 now business improvement districts in Lambeth. We're a very, very small borough. We're sort of 8 miles by 2.5 miles. Not talking about a great big geographical area here, but we are talking about 6 different business improvement districts which bring together local businesses. And as a result of those kind of relationship building exercises, you are beginning to see the benefits. You're beginning to see people think in a local neighbourhood term. So I think that's bringing in added social value. We've also opened up our town hall so that we now have startup businesses in the basement. Again, trying to make a very, very powerful political message that we are there to encourage local business and therefore we are there to enable and facilitate, but obviously also providing an actual venue. So I think there's huge amounts that can be done to take the sort of more negative, what do you do when, you know, not all businesses are great, not all of it's about empowerment, not all of it's connecting. Well, I think part of it is you have to lead by example. Part of it is you have to use your procurement tools, and part of it you have to speak out when they're not, adhering to the kind of values you want. It's very important for us that people we're contracting with pay the living wage. I think that's important. And there are a whole series of other things that we look for in terms of what I would consider kind of an ethical test as to whether they're the kind of people we want them to be doing business with. And I think when we see a big business in our local area doing something that we don't approve of, we need as a local council, because we're an enabler, we're a connector, we are somebody, place of influence, we need to be, you know, making our voice heard, and that's certainly what we try to do. Just very quickly on the housing example, because that's an issue very dear to my heart. The example that was quoted, and thank you very much for that, is in the centre of Brixton. It's called our Summer Leighton Road Development. What we have done is put our land in to work with a community organisation to shape up a development that we will actually do, which is going to involve startup space, housing, and the location of a theatre. So it's going to have huge amounts going on to a very neglected site in the past. And what we've managed to do, and I think this is the innovative bit of the housing scheme, is because it's going to be co-op owned and we're going to be leasing to the co-op, we are able to actually bring about genuinely affordable and social rent on site. Now, why can't we do more of that? I'd love to do more of that. And I know lots of local authorities are exploring how they can bring in extra money and you know, be able to facilitate that kind of positive development. There are some things that also need to be done nationally to enable us to get more money. It is really, I think, a shame that no political party has decided that we can take the cap off the HRA. So that's the housing revenue account, and enabled us to borrow, because there's so much toxicity around the word borrowing, when really, if we change the word borrowing into investment, which is what we're all talking about today, is investing in different ways, investing in people, investing in local areas, investing in local business. It's a bit of a no-brainer for me. So that's disappointment. But we'll keep going on that. Lots of innovative stuff. Final comment I want to make, which was around the community consultation. We are doing lots of different ways of communicating with people. We open up the town hall for a weekend to get people in to help design our website. We've opened up the town hall to have a two-day conference on, you know, let's really look at how we can improve cycling. We are doing things called, which is a bit of a mouthful, ethnographic data collection, which actually means, in normal person language, I think, means that rather than just consulting with people through paper or phoning them up, you're actually going round with them for the day to see exactly what their experiences are. And we've just done some very innovative work around transgender people. I think it's really exploiting all of the different tools. But fundamentally, I think it comes back to, and this is the point I want to leave with, is that you are in the business of shaping services around and with and for people, and therefore consultation is critical to that, because consultation is around collaboration, engagement, working with, collaborative working. And if you kind of lose that point that really it's about people, then quite clearly, if you've not got that, then you're just doing consultations for tick box exercise, and you're not really thinking about how you might want to communicate with people. I think that's really the sort of the fundamental philosophy of the report that we've launched today.
Thanks. Kim, I don't know if there are any particular things you want to come back on. A lot of questions there. It strikes me that, I mean, one of them in particular, apart from reference to your accent, which some people see as a positive. As I'm from Nottingham in the East Midlands, I'm less sure about that. But anyway, it is this question that Nick was raising about what the future of work is going to be like, and whether or not what it feels like to you and your friends, for example, that. You know, do you know many people who are thinking about creating their own business, their own jobs in some way or other, either through a social enterprise or setting up a local business, or even through, you know, setting up a business around care, for example? I just wondered, what does that feel like? Does it feel totally alien, or something that you can imagine people doing? And
I believe that, yeah, young people will make their own companies soon. They will start their own businesses to make their own money, because maybe some people won't employ them. But I think it links back to the comment about the boys that have made the car. The young people that will surprise you are the ones that aren't doing good in school because they're not good academically, but maybe they're better hands-on. So take, for example, personal experiences of family members, little cousins or such that aren't good in school, their behaviour's not exactly good because they can't concentrate, but I know that they're clever in a different way, and their family know, they're more hands-on, they're not good at sitting down and writing things constantly, they might not be good at pulling it across in their exams, but what is an exam to say you're not good at doing something? You might be good at it, but an exam's not going to always prove that. So I think we've got to give them a chance in, yes, they will set up their own companies, but they might not have the grades to do it. You might think now that, oh, they're not going to do anything, but in 10 years' time they'll go, here, I've done it. I'll prove you wrong.
Simon?
Social values, I think, into business was the question that sort of resonated with me. I mean, that's why I enjoy chairing the Employee Ownership Association, because our ambition is to try and get to a position where we're about 10% of employee-owned companies contributing to 10% of GDP in the UK. We're about 4 or 5% at the moment, and we're growing at about 10 plus percent a year. So that's our ambition. The challenge, of course, is about trying to make sure that businesses have got the right values at the heart of their operation, and, you know, those values are then lived and breathed by everyone that works in the business. I've mentioned our constitution. I mean, that sort of gives us, if you like, a set of rules and a set of principles that we work by. But broadly, you know, the founder, Speedon Lewis, when he was putting the business together, was trying to ensure that partners in our operation and our organisation were open to receiving gain, knowledge and power. So gain purely in terms of being able to take the rewards from the business of being a co-owner, and doing that in as equitable a way as possible. Knowledge, hugely important in business terms, to make sure that employees working with you understand what's happening in the business, why it's happening, their influence over what's happening, so that there is real control felt by those that are working in an organisation, because that way you gain engagement and you gain extra productivity and success. And then, of course, power. You know, once you have that knowledge, you need to give people the power to be able to use it, and to use it effectively, and to use it in a way which is going to make the business more successful. So, you know, those three things sort of resonate with me whenever I think about other organisations and how they might possibly look at ways in which they could copy things that John Lewis are doing. It's around gain, knowledge and power for employees.
Okay, thank you. I think we're going to draw this to a close. I should say, I meant to say earlier that a special thanks to Abigail Melville, my colleague and friend, who was the lead associate in developing this report, and also to Jonathan, Brimmy and Atif, who all worked on it as well. I think the conversation we've had has been testament to the value of what's proposed in it, and in response to Charlotte's question, it does seem to me that the attraction of this is it appeals to traditions in each of the three parties, which is not to say that it's at the centre of what every party is saying, but there's certainly something in this for each of the political parties. And finally, let me thank the panel on your behalf, Simon, Stella, who's had to leave, Lib and Kim, for such wonderful contributions.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.